This meeting is now being recorded.
Well done, us. And now I would like to introduce our Chief Administrative Officer, Kurt Soderlund, to say a few opening remarks.
Thank you, Andy. Appreciate it. So welcome, everybody, and we very much appreciate everybody's time in terms of this program, that training program that we're going to be giving. I want to start off first by recognizing all the contributions by the State Controller's Office, who have been a great partner in this training for a number of years at this point. Internally, for the Judicial Council, we've had contributions from our audit section, collections, governmental affairs, and legal in the development of this program. Obviously, one of the things that we're going to be going over are statutory changes and updates, you know, based upon the last legislative session that closed. There's going to be new guidelines also that are going to be discussed. There's going to be mention of the pilot program that we've been working on for some time in terms of looking at ways to make sure that the distributions are all done in a consistent manner. So we want to recognize the courts of Ventura, Santa Clara, and Shasta. There'll also be a discussion about the amnesty program that was launched in October that everybody's paying attention to, and from all we've been able to gather, has really had a significant impact. The legislature also has been looking at these issues, along with the media, particularly on fines and fees and what happens to the money, and there's some complexities that are associated with that. I know yesterday's session we had great attendance. I think it was nearly 170 people. So I would basically say I'm sure this is going to be a wonderful session going forward, and it will be continuance of the training program that we've launched. I think we're in our fourth or fifth year at this point. John Judnick can correct me on that. So without any further ado, I'm going to introduce Andy.
Thank you, Kurt. I appreciate it. And I don't know if everybody knows, but Kurt has decided to retire at the end of this month and will be tending his farm and property in the northern part of the state. We will miss you very much. We appreciate your leadership, and many of us will keep your cell number for calls.
Okay, thanks, Andy. Yeah, I guess after 42 years, that's enough time to put in. So thanks so much.
Today we will be introducing all of the faculty and staff. There are a few housekeeping items I'd like to share with you, and then we'll be reviewing the training expectations and goals for the day. The topics we're going to be covering from the State Controller's Office, the urgency legislation and other legislative updates that impact distributions. We're going to talk about new and updated legislation for the guidelines. The TC-31 has been updated to accommodate amnesty. We're going to be talking about that. And then the listserv notifications, also good information. Judicial Council staff is going to be talking about the uniform bail and penalty schedule. You'll see that it says proposed in italics. It is going to the Judicial Council later this month for approval, at which time the proposed will go away. We'll talk about court legislation that impacts the courts, both for the purposes of operations and collections and distributions. We'll talk about a couple of other activities, court-ordered debt task force, the pilot program. We'll talk to you about the Commission on the Future of the California Court System. We'll provide an overview of the revenue and distribution amnesty FAQs, and then we're going to talk about audits and audit findings, both from the Judicial Council and the State Controller's Office. Later, at the very end of the session, we'll talk a little bit about the Spring 2016 revenue distribution trainings, which will be regional in-person trainings. Always very popular, and we will be asking you all for some input on what kinds of workshops would be most helpful. And then we will wrap up with some of your questions from today and a discussion about training certification. Today from the State Controller's Office, presenting will be Michael Gungan and Don Lowry, And their contact information is listed here, localgovpolicy@sco.ca.gov. Joining me from Judicial Council will be John Judnick, Courtney Tucker, Robert Cabral, I understand, is on vacation but listening in, spying on us, making sure we get it right. The Revenue and Collections Unit, Dan will be speaking, Dan Delgadillo, Maria Lira, Theda Salazar, Linda Culpepper, all there for support, and they can be contacted at revenuedistribution@jud.ca.gov. Now we'll go over a few housekeeping items. The first, and one not listed here, is that you do not need to try and transcribe everything that we say to you today. This PowerPoint will be made available. The information will be repeatable. You will have access to it. So do your best to listen, make notes, jot down questions. There will be opportunities, but don't feel that you have to memorize everything we say. The conference line you're on is listen only to avoid some background noise. As much as we love your hold music, we'd like to get through this today in a little over 90 minutes. If you have questions, and we hope many of you will, please use the WebEx chat feature on your screen and send those questions specifically to Maria Lira in our revenue distribution unit. She will review them, and those of us around the state who are participating today will answer the questions that we can easily answer today. Others might be more complicated, and we will follow up with you directly and may even include some of those meatier questions in our FAQs. You'll note as we go through today's program that there are a number of breaks actually built in between sections, and that's an excellent time for you not to worry about missing any content and an opportunity to submit those questions to us. Two notes. You must be registered to be able to ask questions on that chat feature, but more importantly, you must be registered in order to receive training completion certification. So if you're in a room and only one person in that room has registered but you would like to have training certification, you too must register for today's training. Please go ahead and register by the end of today. And again, all of the questions that we receive from you today and afterwards will be considered for our frequently asked questions sections. You will be asked to provide your evaluation of today's training. Please complete and return the evaluation questionnaire. You'll receive it after the training. Your feedback is super important to us. It's going to let us know how we're doing, if you're getting the information that you find is most helpful, and also it will help us prepare for the spring trainings. So once you get that evaluation, please return it to us at Revenue Distribution at jud.ca.gov by December 23rd. Like I said yesterday, that's our Christmas present from you. The training PowerPoint will be up on the website on or before the end of this week. You'll be able to find it at that link below, thecourts.ca.gov/revenue-distribution.htm. And a 90-minute training completion certificate will be sent to registered participants upon request. And that's the email that you need to send that request to. Two notes about the certificate. First, please don't request it during today's training. You're only entitled to get your certificate after having spent 90-plus minutes with us. And it will be delivered to you in the next 7 to 10 days. So be patient. We're getting it out. We need to process everybody's registration, and we will, in fact, get it to you. Now, today's training goals will include reviewing changes to the trial court revenue distribution guidelines. Many of you have heard us talk about Appendix C in the past. We are now referring to those as the trial court revenue distribution guidelines. We're going to identify changes to the 2016 Uniform Bail and Penalty Schedule. We're going to review and discuss frequently asked questions related to revenue distribution. We'll provide an overview of audit findings with regards to distribution issues. I'll give you a brief update on the distribution pilot program, and then we'll have a minute to talk about the spring 2016 trainings that are coming up. So we are the Judicial Council of California and the State Comptroller's Office. We are not actually the Department of Making Things Far More Complicated Than They Need to Be, despite what you may think after today's training. And in fact, actually, if you think about it, when we advance to the next slide, you'll see this is very straightforward. This is really intuitive. Everybody understands how the collections and distribution process works. And if that doesn't help you, this next slide will really just clarify it for you. Now, I say this with some degree of humor. We all know this is very complicated material, and we are hoping that today's presentation, as well as our ongoing efforts to provide you with feedback and technical support, will help you wade through this very difficult process. So with that, I am going to introduce Michael Gungan and Don Lowry from the State Comptroller's Office to start this training.
Thank you, Andy. Hello, everyone. Again, my name is Michael Gungan, and I have with me Don Lowry of the Local Government Policy Section of SCO's Division of Accounting and Reporting. Now, for this portion of the session, we'll mainly focus on the updates to the Trial Court Revenue Distribution Guidelines, formerly known as Appendix C, and the guidance that SCO will be providing on the urgency legislation passed this year, the codes added or amended by legislation this year, the TC-31 submission process, and lastly, the listserv that we have set up to notify you whenever changes have been made to our site. Now, one of the primary responsibilities in our section, again, we'd like to remind you that this PowerPoint is available on our site, so if you missed anything, we encourage you to visit our website at this address. This is where you'll find the training PowerPoints from our previous trainings, the Trial Court Revenue Distribution Guidelines, and other useful resources to better understand distribution. Now, at this point, I'd like to turn over the discussion to Don Lowry for this year's legislative updates and information on the TC-31 process.
Thank you again for joining us. My name is Don Lowry, and along with Michael, I'm a fiscal analyst in the Local Government Policy Section. I'm going to start off today discussing the urgency legislation passed in 2015 that impacts the Trial Court Revenue Distribution Guidelines. As a reminder, urgency legislation takes effect immediately upon enactment, so these laws are already in effect. Detailed guidance regarding the amnesty program is currently on our website at the address you see on the screen. Guidance regarding the other legislation is under review and should be posted shortly. For the sake of convenience, I shall cover the urgency legislation in four groups. The first set of codes I'd like to point out to you cover fees associated with filing motions in various situations. The current level of filing fees was scheduled to be reduced this year, but the levels have been extended to June 30th, 2018 at the levels you see on the screen. Second, a new filing fee has been added. This fee applies to high-frequency litigants, which are defined as plaintiffs who have filed 10 or more construction-related accessibility claims within the previous 12 months, or attorneys who represent 10 or more such plaintiffs. They are charged an additional $1,000 for construction-related accessibility claims on top of the standard filing fee. Half of the additional fee will support the California Commission on Disability Access, while the other half will go to the Trial Court Trust Fund. third group of codes I wish to point out are all water-related. The group of three water code sections listed at the bottom of the screen add or enhance civil penalties for violating water conservation regulations or orders, whether coming from the State Water Resources Control Board or local water agencies. The penalties will go to the Water Rights Fund at the state level or to the local water agencies, depending on who is levying the penalties. Fish and Game Code Section 12025.1 levies a civil penalty of $8,000 per violation if the offender constructs or maintains any device or contrivance that prevents, impedes, or tends to prevent or impede the passage of fish up and downstream. If the obstruction is related to the cultivation or production of a controlled substance, the penalty is distributed 40% to the Timber Regulation and Forest Restoration Fund, 30% to the county where the violation occurred, and 30% to the agency which investigated the violation. If the obstruction is not related to controlled substance cultivation or production, the penalty is distributed 40% to the Fish and Game Preservation Fund, 30% to the county where the violation occurred, and 30% to the agency which investigated the violation. Finally, I want to highlight the state amnesty program adopted this year. As you are aware, this program went into effect October 1st and will continue until March 31st, 2017. The program, which covers infractions and, with local approval, certain vehicle code misdemeanors, allows for offenders to reduce the amount of their fines by 50 to 80%. However, in terms of revenue distribution, the only change for local courts and counties is that the state penalty fund portion of the remittance will be reported on a separate line item on the TC-31. We'll be talking about that form in a few minutes, and we'll point out the differences on the form at that time. The reason for the separate line item is the state penalty fund distribution is different for amnesty program payments going into two funds instead of the usual eight. Next, I want to turn to the complete list of codes that have been added or amended in 2015 affecting the trial court revenue distribution guidelines. You will note that this list does include the urgency legislation previously discussed. These changes are in italics. All of these updates will be captured in the forthcoming revision 26, which we estimate posting on our website in early 2016. Today, I want to highlight three of the more interesting or unusual pieces of legislation that passed this year. First, as you may be aware, the state has adopted legislation which will regulate the cultivation, distribution, and sale of medical marijuana. Included in those laws are two code sections impacting the guidelines. Both provisions apply civil penalties for violations to those licensed to engage in commercial cannabis activity, as well as those who are not licensed. This is in addition to any criminal prosecution and associated fines that might occur. I'm highlighting these sections because even though the laws passed with a great deal of press attention, the various state agencies charged with implementation must still draft the regulations and come up with a regulatory framework. It will therefore take some time before these laws are actually taking effect, and we will be updating you as further information becomes available. On a similar note, Public Resources Code Section 42364 outlaws the sale or offering for promotional purposes personal care products containing plastic microbeads. Violators will be subject to a civil penalty up to $2,500 per day. However, this law does not take effect until January 1st, 2020, so for the next 4 years, people will still be free to sell toothpaste, facial cleansers, and other products containing plastic microbeads. Finally, I want to highlight Fish and Game Code Section 12025, which was amended this year to expand the list of applicable penalties. This section imposes civil penalties for a variety of violations that occur in connection with the production or cultivation of controlled substances, on public or private lands. Depending on the offense and whether the offender is trespassing or there with permission of the owner, the civil penalties range from $8,000 to $40,000 per violation. The offenses include littering, dumping, hazardous waste disposal, illegal hunting, illegal logging, the cutting or destroying of plants without permission, or diverting the flow of rivers and streams, or damaging rivers and lake beds, just to name a few. Much as with the urgency legislation we discussed earlier, the penalties will be distributed 40% to the Timber Regulation and Forest Restoration Fund, 30% to the county where the violation occurred, and 30% to the agency investigating the violation. Moving on to the TC-31 forms, as you know, these forms are used to report collections which are remitted to the state. We have included on this slide a link to the current TC-31 form. Please be sure you regularly check to see whether the form has been updated. The current form, as we will see in a moment, includes a line item for reporting the state penalty fund portion for amnesty collections. Overall, the TC-31 form is 3 pages plus instructions. Both the form and the payment are to be sent to the state treasurer at either address shown on the slide. The treasurer's office will in turn send copy of the TC-31 to the state controller's office. The form includes several of the most commonly used remittance code, but as we know, distributions to other codes, to other funds with other codes are possible. If you have any questions about a remittance that is not listed on the form, please contact the state controller's office at fiscalcontrol@sco.ca.gov for advice. You are asked and indeed strongly encouraged to do so before submitting a remittance and payment, as correcting an improperly routed payment is more difficult than reporting it properly the first time. I've been asked to share with you some of the most common issues that occur with filling out TC-31 forms. If you are submitting a payment due to an audit finding, please use a separate TC-31 form than your regular remittance. In filling out the form, as the example on the slide shows, please enter 99 as the month code at the top of the form and write audit in place of the month further down. This will ensure that the payment is properly recorded. Some of the other issues that have been reported to us, we've been asked to remind you about. An original signature is required on the TC-31 form. As you're completing the form, please include the fiscal year on the form with the various remit codes as you're filling it out. Finally, if you're using the Excel spreadsheet and planning on submitting that, there's no need to use the dollar sign when you enter the amount, simply the amount itself. One final point. The bottom line amount on the TC-31 cannot be a negative number. Any adjustment that would create a negative number should be reported as a separate line item, and as the FAQ we've highlighted in the slide indicates, should be broken down over several pages or offset over several months. The total listed on any particular TC-31 form should be a positive number. For more detailed information, please see the July 2014 FAQ that we've linked on the slide. Our FAQs may also be found on the trial court's website we've referred to earlier. When remitting payments on the TC-31 form for offenders participating in the amnesty program, you'll be using a special line item to report their state penalty fund payment. The line item can be found at line 23 on page 2 of the TC-31. As you can see, the description of the fund is State Penalty Fund, Vehicle Code 42008.8, Amnesty, and is marked on the form itself with a star. If you do not see this line item, You may not be using the current TC31 form, so I would encourage you to go back to the web address we provided a few slides ago and make sure you've downloaded the current TC31 form. As a reminder, this line item is only for reporting the state penalty fund portion of the remittance from amnesty program participants. Other components of their fines will be reported as normal. Finally, I'd like to encourage you to sign up for our email subscription service for updates if you have not already done so. You can find the link at the bottom of the trial court's webpage or go to the address on the slide here. Please sign up with your name and email address, and you'll be added to our list to receive notification from our unit as the revenue distribution guidelines, the FAQs, and other documents on our website are updated, as well as other announcements that are issued from this office. And with that, I've reached the conclusion of this portion of our presentation, and we'll now turning it back to Andy, but encouraging you to submit your questions, if you have them, to Maria Lira.
Excellent. Thank you very much, you guys. We appreciate it. So here we are on one of those natural pauses to our presentation. If there are any questions that you have for Michael and Don, submit them, as Don encouraged you, to Maria Lira, and we will see those questions and get some of them, as many as possible, answered at the end of today, and the rest we'll get back to you directly. And many, I'm sure, will make their way onto the frequently asked questions sections of both the SEO and Judicial Council sites. So now we're going to turn to Courtney Tucker and maybe some support from John Judnick to talk about the ever-exciting uniform bail and penalty schedules.
Thank you, Andy. This is John Judnick, and with me in San Francisco is Courtney Tucker. Courtney.
Thank you, John. I'm the attorney that staffs the Judicial Council's Traffic Advisory Committee. The committee is responsible for making annual recommendations to the council for adoption of statewide bail schedules. The council is meeting on Friday, and we have on the consent agenda the proposed schedules for 2016. So those will be posted after the council officially adopts them. There are two code sections that require the schedules be prepared annually. Penal Code 1269B, subsection C, requires courts prepare and adopt annual revised uniform countywide schedule of bail for felony and misdemeanor violations. The infraction schedule is, for the vehicle code, is established by the Judicial Council, and specifically under Vehicle Code Section 40310, the council is required to annually adopt a schedule for traffic infractions, and certainly if the law changes during the course of the year, we can adopt an additional schedule. I think one year there were three schedules that were adopted because the law changed three times. On the next slide, the countywide bail schedules that are required under the penal code, the judges have to adopt a schedule and apply the requirements that apply to that jurisdiction, so the make adjustments based on how much the specific amount is for that county for the county penalty, whether they have emergency medical services penalty that's been approved by the Board of Supervisors. And then in addition, there are 30 counties that under Penal Code Section 1463.28 have authority to have bail schedule amounts that exceed those set by the council. And that has to be approved by the Board of Supervisors as well.
Courtney, how many counties or courts actually send in annually their bail schedule as required by statute to you?
It's actually a low number. We're not a police agency. We don't police them. We give them a reminder every year, but probably it's like 15-20% that actually send it to us. And the statute says mail, and we certainly will accept it by email if that's easier, and we may get that statute changed so that it doesn't say mail anymore.
Okay, so as a reminder to everyone listening in your courts or counties, you should ensure that you send it in. Courtney, as he said, will accept it by email as opposed to mail, but that's a requirement by statute.
And the court is supposed to identify any ways in which the local schedule differs from the council's. So there's a link to where the 2015, the current bail schedule is posted, and on that same page, the 2016 schedules will be posted at the end of the week. So the purpose of the schedule is different for the council's infraction schedule than it is for, say, a misdemeanor or felony bail schedule, which is the amount you have to post to be released from custody. The council's schedule for infractions is the bail amount that is the fine that you would pay. If you don't want to contest your case, you can post and forfeit it. You can get a payment plan for it. If you want to go to trial, and you go to trial, it establishes the standard fine and penalties that the court can impose, but the court has discretion to impose a different amount once you get in front of the bench officer in the courtroom. So this is the base page to the schedules. There are schedules for traffic, boating, forestry, fishing game, public utilities, parks and recreation, business licensing. The only schedule that's mandatory for the entire state with local modifications is the traffic infraction schedule. The misdemeanor traffic schedule and the other schedules are permissive. There are recommendations by the council that for courts to follow. The courts have discretion to adjust those as they see fit. And so this year, the minor changes to the schedule, this is the second year in a row where the changes have been fairly minor, just some updates to statutes to reflect changes to code sections, some new laws that have been put into place, and those have been added to the schedule. The schedule is not comprehensive. It does not include all possible violations, and I'll get into that in a second. One change is that Rule 4.105 has been added, discussion of that in Section 4G on page Roman numeral 7 of the preface. Rule 4.105 is the new rule that applies to bail for traffic cases, actually for all infractions now. It was expanded to address any infraction. The misconception in the media and other in the public somewhat is that it's a no bail rule, but that's not accurate. It's actually presumed to be no bail, but there are certain circumstances by statute where the court is required to have bail deposited. If someone wants a trial by written declaration, or if someone wants to appear for trial without arraignment first, the statute, the codes require that the person deposit bail. So that's, and then down below in Section H of Section 4, those are the default amounts for various code sections. If the violation is not listed in the schedule, then you go to this default amount. The next page, page 8, has standard breakdowns for traffic. I have not included that here. Generally, this is going to be posted online as a reference for everyone, so we're not going to go into each individual change that occurred to the schedule. This is just to give you an overview. This slide shows the breakdown of bail. The schedule is intended as providing a breakdown of what's correct to collect. Does not give a full breakdown of the distribution. That's the what was this Appendix C and is now the Court Revenue Distribution Guidelines. So in this on this page 17 of the schedule, there's three entries that relate to electric bicycles, which is one of the popular things that was in legislation this year. There's a number of bills that dealt with new technology, different kinds of assisted bicycles, electric, various sorts of hoverboard sort of kind of things, kind of like the Segway without a handle. I don't know exactly what those are called, but anyway.
For many of the courts out there and for the counties, if you're configuring new systems, what audit services uses, first we always go to statute, and we'll talk more about this near the end of this today's presentation, but we use statute and read statute, then we go to the controller's guidelines, which used to be referred to as Appendix C, to see what the guidelines say on a narrative basis, kind of converting statute into narrative to see where the money is distributed to. And we use Courtney's uniform bell and penalty schedule that you're seeing here to see what the dollars are for each of the individual buckets so we can look at this. And we'll talk later on about worksheets, but this is what we use to kind of cross-check the worksheets when you put in the basic bail amounts and then to see the total bail at the end before you add in a lot of other items that are local ordinances up to the Board of Supervisors or approved locally. It's important to use all these things when you're doing this work, but this is a critical cross-check document for you, and then you match it to your own local uniform bail schedule on the county level.
And so on Friday, after the schedule is adopted by the council, it's on the consent agenda, and once that is officially adopted, we will send an electronic version to the court execs and presiding judges for them to distribute to the court staff. And so if the court has any local adjustments that need to be made, there are reference cells in the Excel document that allow the court to update things like the county penalty amount, whether the court has the EMS penalty or night court. So, you know, as you can see in the columns here, you have the base fine, the state penalty, county penalty, DNA, court construction penalty, the surcharge of 20%, emergency medical services, the EMATS penalty of $4, which is a flat amount, and that is a penalty. A lot of people make the mistake of referring to it as a fee. It's not a fee. It's a penalty assessment. Court operations, conviction assessment. If the court has a traffic assistance program fee, that can be also entered, and the whole schedule recalculates based on the information that's added to the reference cells in the document.
And when you reference this on the far left-hand side, review the footnotes. I know it's in very small print, but it's critical to look at those footnotes if they apply to see what else you might have to do. Don't forget about that.
Thank you, John. So on the next slide, we have in the preface, there are a couple of minor changes. One thing is that Senate Bill 326 amended Government Code Section 76,000.10, which was due to sunset on January 1st of 2016. It's been extended for 2 years, so it is required through January 1st, 2018 now. Section 4C1 on page 5 of the preface is revised to clarify that the Vehicle Code Section 42001 allows local entities who employ peace officers to set a fine schedule for bicycle violations that occur in their jurisdiction. Previously, the schedule had identified that that was something that colleges and universities could do, but the statute actually authorizes any local entity that employs peace officers to enforce the vehicle code to have a local bail schedule. And so Davis has one, Coronado and San Diego is considering one. Interesting to see how that policy may mushroom across the state, which could create a lot of challenges for courts if you have different jurisdictions in your county setting different bail schedule for bicycle violations in the county.
And we're looking right now into that statute and how it's interpreted and how things might change based upon the different interpretations.
And as I mentioned, there is the added information in the preface at Section 4G on page 7 about Rule 4.105. So we have a breakdown of the specific entries that have been revised or added to the infraction schedule. So you see many of them dealing with bicycles, motorized boards, electric bicycles. There is changes to the requirements for oversized loads in terms of flags and lamps. The size of the flag is, I think, bigger. You can have it red or orange. Very minor changes, but they're captured in the bail schedule. On the next slide, the one I want to make sure you know is not a typo, 25305A through C, use of fusees specified. And that is a flare. Apparently, this is something I never knew, so I'm sure, you know, many of you will not know what a fusee is, but it's a flare. And so the new law says you cannot attach a fusee to your vehicle, which I can't believe anybody thought that would be a good idea, but apparently that's now a law that you cannot do that. There's some statutes that amend the code regarding limousines, buses, weight requirements, various different restrictions on operation of buses. The next slide shows misdemeanor offenses that have been added to the traffic schedule. And these, again, are permissive. They're recommended amounts. Local courts can modify that schedule. The first few deal with refusal to respond to orders by police and firefighters, and those fine amounts have been increased. There's a number of bills that dealt with tow trucks and restricting and regulating tow trucks and how they operate. Tow trucks can't just drive up to you and say, do you need a tow? They have to be summoned now, and they have to provide certain information about how much you're going to be charged if you're towed and how much it's going to cost to get you out of the tow lot and things like that. And so the next slide has some more towing violations and violations dealing with various motor carrier inspection requirements.
And as Courtney has stated, he's listing these as being added to the Uniform Bail and Penalty
Schedule. Or amended.
And again, as he said earlier, the Uniform Bail and Penalty Schedule doesn't list everything. So if you can't find it there, it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It's just not listed there. And many of these items you will not see very often when you're looking at violations coming in and processing paperwork.
So that's an overview, and that's all going to be posted online for your reference. And as I said, we'll be sending out a memo with the specific details to the courts on Friday about how to adjust the local bail schedules. And so we've provided additional resources as to where the council report is posted, where the council's bail schedule is posted, contact information for me if you have any questions about the local bail schedule or the council's bail schedule. My phone number and email address are there.
Thank you very much. Good information. Again, we are at one of those natural pauses in the presentation where if you have questions and would like to submit them to us, this would be a good time using that WebEx chat feature and addressing your questions to Maria Lira, who is diligently distributing them to all of us so that we can ideally answer some of them at the end of today's presentation. Now we're going to talk a little bit about a document that is produced in Government Affairs of Judicial Council called Court-Related Legislation, and you'll see there's a link here on this page, courts.ca.gov/documents/2015_legsummary.pdf, and on the next slide you'll see what that document looks like. So when you access this. Now, this isn't just legislative updates that impact collections. It's really anything that's going to impact the judicial branch entities, and in some cases even judicial branch stakeholders. So it's a pretty comprehensive document. I'd like to draw your attention to the right, down towards the bottom, you'll see the number 30, that's the page, and Appendix C. That is not the Appendix C that is the previous name of the Trial Court Revenue Distribution Guidelines. That's Appendix C, which you'll see on the next slide, is really for new and expanded crimes, which have a very important link to changes in collections and distributions. So if you haven't accessed this document, if you haven't seen it before, it is a good resource. We strongly encourage you to go online and download it and use this as a review for what you might find changing in the collections and distribution universe. Now I'd like to move on to a couple of other items that we want to touch on. The first will be the revenue distribution pilot program of the Court-Ordered Debt Task Force. We'll talk a little bit about the Commission on the Future of California's Court System, which we affectionately call the Futures Commission, and then we're going to talk about frequently asked questions. So as an update for you for the revenue distribution pilot program, this is a function of the court-ordered debt task force, and originally it was focused on simplifying the criminal assessment process. In light of a number of factors, that process has slowed down, and there are other entities that are taking a look at the criminal assessment process, specifically distributions. But the factors included the very convoluted nature of collections. As you know, collections and distribution are very difficult. There are a lot of moving parts. There are many stakeholders, and sometimes the issues and needs of those stakeholders compete with one another. Earlier this year, adding to the complications that this issue presented to us, the United States Department of Justice issued a report on the riots in Ferguson, Missouri, and it was determined that court-ordered debt was a very important contributing factor to a cycle of poverty that makes it very, very difficult for people to ever get out of poverty. Following that, there was a report here in California, it's not just a Ferguson problem, that focused on how that cycle of debt from the collections process in California has a similar impact on very low-income people and people of color. So as a result of all of these elements, the convoluted nature of collections, the disparate stakeholders, the fact that we've got a potential cycle of debt that is encouraged by the collections and penalty process, we've decided to take a new approach to looking at the way court-ordered debt is collected and distributed in the state. One of the things that we are doing is the Futures Commission, which I'll talk about in a moment, is focusing a huge amount of energy trying to figure out what makes sense for the branch and branch entities. And then beyond just a branch solution, beyond the Futures Commission, we're working for a three-branch solution. The Chief Justice is working with leadership in the legislature. She's working with the governor's office and the governor's people to identify the best way to address this issue on a statewide three-branch approach. So we anticipate more information in the coming months, but that pilot program that we was initiated in prior years really has come to a slow while we approach these new, while we address these new approaches to the problem. Now let's talk a moment about the Futures Commission, formerly the Commission on the Future of California's Court System. And on this slide you'll see from the Chief Justice, Tani Cantil-Sakauye, she says, the goal of the Futures Commission is to catalyze change. It will take a fresh look at legal and structural challenges to long-term efficiency and stability for the judicial branch and develop practical, achievable recommendations that may be implemented by the Judicial Council, the legislature, or the governor. So you see she's in this sweeping statement addressing both that three-branch solution that we want to talk about with collections and distribution, and also looking for opportunities to provide efficiencies within the judicial branch. Now, the Futures Commission is looking at a variety of issues, but I think of the top four right now, we want to discuss with you two concepts that we think are pertinent to the collections and distribution issues that all of us are concerned with. The first is collection of court-ordered debt. So, generally speaking, we're talking about the uniform data reporting and collection efforts in order to effectively monitor outstanding fines and fees, ensure that they are paid. We need to realign the court-ordered debt collection process and conduct a comprehensive evaluation of court-ordered debt collection practices and responsibilities. So you may ask why this is being considered by the Futures Commission, and there are a couple of reasons, but perhaps paramount among them A little over a year ago, the Legislative Analyst's Office issued a report called Restructuring the Court-Ordered Debt Collection Process in California. I think many of you are familiar with that report because we made it available to you, shared it with all of the courts and the county collection programs. Among the findings in that report, it found that the current court-ordered debt collection process lacks clear fiscal incentives for programs to collect debt in a cost-effective manner or to maximize collections. The LAO also found it difficult to comprehensively evaluate and compare the performance of existing collection programs due to a lack of complete, consistent, and accurate reporting from one program to another. And finally, the current statutory division of collection responsibilities between counties and courts can sometimes undermine the oversight and modification of collection programs, making it difficult to make improvements. So the goals and potential strategies being contemplated by the Futures Commission include whether to realign the current court-ordered debt collection process so that a single entity is responsible for collections. The Futures Commission subcommittee is looking at ways to provide greater flexibility in how court-ordered debt is collected, and also looking at collections incentive models and way to improve data collection and performance metrics. Another concept being looked at more closely by a subcommittee of the Futures Committee is decriminalizing traffic infractions. We're contemplating here a new model for processing traffic infractions that may include decriminalizing such infractions or shifting their adjudication to an administrative forum. We're exploring the decriminalization of traffic infractions and or moving their processing to administrative or non-criminal forum entirely. Now, I think that we're probably looking at things like that California stop, rolling through a stop sign, or modest speeding tickets. We're not likely to be contemplating here anything that would be significantly dangerous to motorists or pedestrians or bikes, such as driving under the influence or excessive speeds. So you may be wondering why the Futures Commission is looking at this decoupling of traffic infractions from the adjudicative process. There are a couple of reasons. First of all, traffic infractions make up a significant part of the workload that the courts must deal with. There are over 4.5 million traffic infractions filed that are processed through the courts. And for most of us, this is our only contact with the courts, and yet the criminal law procedures under which traffic infractions are governed are sometimes restrictive, they're non-intuitive, they have this sense of impeding access to justice and impairing efficient court operations. For those of us who just have a simple ticket, we want things to be a little bit more straightforward and a little easier to navigate. And all of those procedures that we have to deal with are actually in place to provide criminal defendants for more serious crimes constitutional protection. So perhaps there is a little conflict between those. The high volume cases, which do consume substantial resources at our courts, may be more suitable for a different adjudication forum and procedures. So the goals and potential strategies include the pros and cons of the current system, looking at previous traffic adjudication pilot programs, previous legislatively required studies and recommendations, and alternative systems both in other states and maybe outside the United States. At a minimum, the Commission will consider the following: which infraction violations may be suitable for decriminalization and or resolution in an alternative forum? What role judicial officers in the criminal courts may have in the alternative forum? What are the procedures for parties and for witness participation for trials by written declaration and failures to appear? What is the appropriate burden of proof? and what resolution methods, and who is the appropriate prosecutorial body. So the commission will investigate these as well as the fiscal impacts before any decisions are made. Yesterday, the Futures Commission held an in-person public comment session on the four concepts, these two that we've discussed here, as well as trial court funding and judgeships, the number of judges available for court processes. And that some people did make the journey to the San Francisco Judicial Council office and present their testimony in person. The Futures Commission is accepting comments in writing through the beginning of January. So yesterday was certainly not the only opportunity to provide feedback on these topics. If you would like more information, you can definitely let us know. And then additional in-person sessions are being planned for early next year, and we will make sure that judicial branch stakeholders are all made aware of those opportunities. So with that, I'm going to turn things over now to Daniel Delgadillo, and he is going to talk to us about revenue distribution and amnesty frequently asked questions. Dan?
Thank you, Andy. Good morning, everyone. My name is Daniel Delgadillo, and I'm with the Revenue and Collections Unit based out of Burbank office. So we've been talking about revenue distribution for this whole entire half an hour, an hour. And the good thing that we have in our unit is a resource. And it's a great resource that was developed back in 2013 with collaboration with the State Controller's Office and the Judicial Council Office. And so all the questions that were submitted throughout the period of the time of the revenue distribution trainings that we have had, we compiled an FAQ document that contains many questions on revenue distribution. The document is a living document. It continues to grow. So all the questions that will be submitted today and yesterday's training will be compiled, reviewed, and added to the FAQ. We do have questions from the spring training that still need to get posted and get the document updated, which will be they're in the final stages of those questions being finalized. So it's a living document. It's a good resource for all of you to check out if you get stuck or have a question on revenue distribution. We also have FAQs on amnesty. As we all know, that's a hot topic right now for our collections people. And so there's a section in there that has frequently asked questions. There's approximately like four questions that you all may refer to. As you see in the document or on the slide that is up in front of you, there that's the FAQs for amnesty. And next slide, please. And if you need further information on the FAQs and the website, those are the links for the FAQs, for the revenue distribution FAQs, and for the amnesty. And that's all.
Thank you, Daniel. I appreciate it. So we're at another pause. If you have any questions about legislation, the Futures Commission, the FAQs Daniel was just talking about, please use that WebEx chat feature. Submit your questions to Maria Lira. And now I'm going to turn over the presentation to John Judnick in our audit department, and then he will be followed by the Controller's Office team, and we're going to be talking now about audit findings from both the Judicial Council team and the State Controller's Office. John?
Thank you, Andy. My name is John Judnick. I'm the Senior Manager of Audit Services for the Judicial Council of California. Robert Cabral, who's on vacation this week, I told him he didn't have to listen in today, stay on vacation, but he's one of my audit supervisors based out of Sacramento that deals with a lot of the issues we'll be talking about today. Audit services of the Judicial Council performs regular cycle audits of the Superior Courts. As part of what we do on our regular audits, we do compliance audits, performance audits, financial audits. And one area that we look at when we audit the Superior Courts is revenue distribution. Our work on revenue distribution really is focused on performing a review of case management systems calculations and how they're programmed to do what they're supposed to do in terms of the distribution work and collections, both now, currently, and the recent past. And recent past is roughly about a year. So we're really looking at what you're doing right now in terms of the calculations. The actual test scopes and what we're looking at are those areas and those calculations that are the most complex, your red light, your traffic school areas, the areas where it's more probable that there could be errors. And then we select other distributions that have been found in recent audit reports, not only of audit services of the courts, but of the SCO, the court revenue audits that the SCO auditors do when they do their court revenue audits on their regular cycle also. The one caveat here is that where we go to a court and they're looking at a new case management system coming up within the next 6 months or year, we'll probably defer looking at their existing case management system, what they've done historically, because we're really not going to help them when they go on their new case management system. So we usually defer that work and then talk with courts about their configurations and what they're going to be doing in the future. The revenue distribution guidelines page on the California Courts website is very similar to what the state controller has, and we have links back and forth. These pages on both sites are designed to serve as a central source of information for both trial courts and justice partner stakeholders so they can access the important information and current information on revenue distribution, such as what we've indicated earlier in this presentation. We'll be posting this PowerPoint and other information on the website as current information and changes that have been occurring. SCO's revenue or their distribution guidelines are there. Upcoming and past training modules that have been recorded are there, both the audio recordings and the video recordings that we've done, and other related resources such as our testing spreadsheets. The caveat with the testing spreadsheets is to ensure that when you pull them up, that you get the right year, that because these testing spreadsheets, the tab, is probably as current as we can make it, but if you're testing a prior year, you have to look at the statutes that applied in that year, not the current statutes. So, you know, there's a caution there, and we don't update these as frequently as possible, but we post a little disclaimer at the start of our spreadsheets that we've posted to be sure that you do this accurately. And then if you have any questions, give us a call. And we also indicate that if you're doing top-down distribution of work based upon what the judges order, make sure how you prorate what the judges order. So you can either do soft components, which are your calculated amounts, or you could do hard components and then prorate the rest of the soft components. There's no one real rule in terms of how you do this. The only thing we talk about is do whatever you do, do it consistently, so that in your particular court or county, if anybody looks at it, be it audit services or SCO auditors, that you're doing it on a consistent basis. That's probably the key in terms of any potential guidance that I could give you in that respect. And we have one question that I handled this morning specifically on tops-down work versus bottoms-up. And tops-down, for those of you out there, tops-down is where a judge orders a specific dollar amount, and you have to base your distributions on that dollar amount, versus bottoms-up. You build it based upon statute to a total, kind of looking at Courtney's uniform bill and penalty schedule. This slide that we're showing you now with the arrow is a slide from the California Courts website that shows the revenue distribution guidelines, where the spreadsheets are in the training modules. Now we'll get into issues that we found on recent audits and recent questions that we we have received, and I've also included some be aware of kind of facts here. The domestic violence fee that was effective January 1st, 2014 changed the amount from $400 to $500. Sometimes that doesn't change out there. Our audits are finding that it hasn't been updated for many courts and for a number of judges who still don't make that change. Courts are required to provide a statement of the reason on the record if it exercises any discretion to reduce or waive the fee. The red light area is probably one of the more complex areas that we look at, not only red light, but red light traffic school. So on a red light traffic school cases, the amount distributed for the collections as a 1463.11 red light bail forfeiture was instead distributed incorrectly, and you know we've noted that on a repetitive basis. So using traffic school versus the regular forfeiture process and distribution. A be aware of fact is fines are punitive and are would be from the date of violation due to the ex post facto prohibitions. That means that the court can't impose more punitive fine, possibly at conviction date, than what existed at the time of the violation. So when you're looking at statutes, also a caveat is that when you read the statute, read what it says in terms of the applicability. Is it conviction date? Is it violation date? You have to be real careful about that when you review statute. And this includes the state restitution fine per case law. The restitution fine is not subject to penalty assessments, and we've got that in the FAQs, and we consistently tell people to go through the process of reviewing statute, but also look at the FAQs. In this case, it's FAQ C61, where we've already received the question and have already responded to it. FAQs are an absolutely critical source, as Daniel said just a few moments ago. Penal Code 1205.3, this is another be aware of. When prohibition is granted for an offense, fines, including restitution fines, can be converted to community service, but fees cannot be converted. Where a defendant may have multiple cases filed against him or her, and the judicial officer decides to hear those cases concurrently because the violations were filed separately, the base fines should not be added before calculating the penalties. Again, we've got that in the FAQs. Go to the FAQs. This next item, which the SCO will be talking about in a few minutes, Government Code 76000.3, concerns the additional $3 penalty on parking offenses that went into effect January 1st of 2011. So when you look at the parking offenses, it used to be $4.50, now it's additional $3 for a total of $7.50. So when that money is collected, no matter what you collect out there, $7.50 comes up to the state. We've seen that in a couple of issues, and that's been a very increased focus of the state controllers on their court revenue audits in the last 2 years. And they're finding a number of courts and counties where that is not being done correctly. Distribution priorities, the state surcharge of 20% under Penal Code 1465.7. It is a priority two, not a priority one, not a priority three. It's a priority two. And this is when we're talking about priorities, we're talking about installment payments. Thank you, Courtney. That's always the case when we talk about priorities. Red light bail forfeiture cases. Under Penal Code 1463.11, 30% allocation to the EMAT penalty assessment is not being applied, and we're seeing that less so now than we have in the past, but we're still seeing it. On the 2% state automation calculation and distribution, again, this is assessed on all fines, penalties, and forfeitures, not on fees. Again, seeing it less so than we have in the past, but we're still seeing it being done. And then Vehicle Code 42007 converts the fines and penalties to a traffic violator school fee, and the 2% has been noted to be incorrectly calculated and distributed from the fines and penalties for traffic school cases. Again, as always with statute, when you're doing it, you have to look for the exceptions. The exception here is for child seat traffic school cases, and be aware of that because we're seeing that also. Okay, this is a new slide that we haven't talked about in the past, and then it's pretty much detailed here in terms of the statutory scheme for proof of correction on a proof of insurance issue. Not to get into the detail, but under Vehicle Code 16028, when you have motorists who get cited for proof of insurance issues by the traffic officer, you have to pay the fine and the forfeiture that's imposed and collected. Once it's collected by whoever collects it, then $17.50 of that amount collected in the county goes into the county fund as being held as an agent for the court. That fund is supposed to be, or is typically called, the Special Financial Responsibility Trust Fund under that Penal Code section. The $17.50 goes into that fund, and it's effectively, as I said, a court trust account, or being held by the county for the benefit of the court as an agent. And the court has to send either on an annual basis or more frequently, we recommend at least annually, the court is supposed to send in its expenses to the county to seek reimbursement. The county's got to hold that in that fund until the court seeks that reimbursement. And again, hopefully do it annually or more frequently. But to the extent the money held in that trust fund exceeds the amount being required for the period seeking reimbursement, then the county treasurer is allowed to redeposit and distribute the money in accordance with Penal Code 1463. We're finding a number of times that this has come, that courts have had issues on this in terms of the frequency of seeking reimbursement or just to seek reimbursement after a few years. Again, the county's got to continue to hold that money until a period is closed off by the court. It can't move that money without discussing it with the court for the period involved. Board of Supervisor Resolutions just had an issue this morning contacted by a court. If you impose assessments that require a Board of Supervisor resolution, make sure you have on file that current board resolution for the assessment you're doing. If the board resolutions are missing, ask the county for the resolutions to support what you're imposing. That's very critical. Now, we've also heard that courts go to the counties and the counties don't have it or can't find it, because some of these are very old, and whether they're old or not, they may still be evergreen. We recommend that you go to the county and talk to the county clerk or the county council and say, if you can't find them, could you please go to the Board of Supervisors and adopt a new resolution to affirm the amounts that are being assessed now for all the areas that should be assessed or that you're assessing, and put that into a central file to make sure you have it available. This is clearly important when you're doing your new case management systems out there and you're configuring those. You have to make sure that you have those resolutions on hand for those assessments. I know State Controllers has, their audit team has issued emails to various courts and counties asking them to make sure that they reconfirm those dollar amounts and obtain those resolutions. It just makes life easier on everybody to have those when an audit is upcoming from either audit services or the state controller's office. The primary code sections that I'm talking about in terms of having Board of Supervisor resolutions include these that you're seeing now on the slide. There are a lot of others. I'm just talking about a few on this slide that come up on a regular basis. If you go to the workbooks, and when you see the workbooks or work with those workbooks that we have available, those worksheets, they'll normally indicate on the line item BOS, you know, and BOS is Board of Supervisors. That's telling you that you should have those resolutions for those assessments. And that is the end of at least my piece of audit and distribution issues that we're seeing, and I'll hand it over to State Controllers in Sacramento.
Thank you, John. Now, in this portion of the session, we will discuss the common audit findings from the State Comptroller's Office. Our Division of Audits has wanted to point out these three issues in their audits of court revenue distribution. The first being that the installment payments have not been distributed properly by priority. Secondly, universities and colleges are not remitting parking surcharges to the counties. And lastly, maintenance of effort and 50-50 split payments are being distributed incorrectly. So the purpose of this part of the session is to help recognize these problem areas and use correct distribution. But before we move on to the findings, let's take a look at where we can find the audits and the audit reports done by SCO's Division of Audit. So this is what SCO's Court Revenue Audit Reports webpage looks like. If you want to review our audit reports, please visit the website highlighted on this slide. Now on to the findings. So the first finding that I'll cover is installment payments are not being distributed correctly by distribution priorities. Now, if you'd like more information on distribution priorities, please refer to the Trial Court Revenue Distribution Guidelines, Revision 25. In this revision, features have been added to make these priorities clear by code. These features include a dedicated page on C7 and also a priority of installment payments column on tables 1 through 7, as you'll see in this slide. Now, if you have any questions on code distribution priority, feel free to email us at the address provided here, localgovpolicy@sco.ca.gov. Now, moving on to our second finding, this relates to public and private universities and colleges. They are not remitting parking surcharges to the county. Now, in Government Code 7372B, it states, in those cities, districts, or other issuing agencies which elect to accept parking penalties and otherwise process parking violations pursuant to Article 3, commencing with Section 4200 of Chapter 1 of Division 17 of the Vehicle Code, that city, district, or issuing agency shall observe the increased bail amounts as established by the court, reflecting the added penalty provided by this subdivision. Each agency that elects to process parking violations shall pay to the county treasurer $4.50 for the parking penalty imposed by this subdivision for each violation that is not filed in court. In Government Code 76000B, it says the same exact thing, except instead of remitting $4.50 to the county treasurer, you would be remitting $2.50. But how can public and private universities and colleges be held accountable for remitting parking surcharges? The key word here is issuing agencies. Now, although this term is not defined in Vehicle Code 40200, which pertains to parking violations, the term issuing agency is defined in Vehicle Code 40250 for toll evasion violations, as any entity, public or private, authorized to collect tolls. So for the purposes of Vehicle Code 40200, an issuing agency is a public or private entity authorized to collect parking penalties. Therefore, these universities and colleges that have used the authority of Vehicle Code 21113 to regulate the parking or standing of vehicles fall under the definition of an issuing agency and are subject to the transfer requirements of Government Code 7372B and 76000B. And so our last finding here pertains to maintenance of effort payments and the 50-50 split payment. Government Code 77205A requires counties to remit 50% of specified collections that exceed the amount specified in Government Code 77201.1B2 or Government Code 77205C, depending on the county, to the state, and the other 50% to the county general fund. Now, our audit division would like to point out that these specified collections used in the calculation of the 50-50 split should be the distribution as they read December 31st, 1997, pursuant to Government Code 77205A. Listed here are the specified fees and assessments that go into calculating the amount that must be remitted 50% to the state and 50% to the county general fund. Again, the point we'd like to stress is that this calculation will be based on how these codes read on December 31st, 1997. So as an example of the calculation, these five counties have their amounts noted in Government Code 77205C. Now, if you're not one of these counties, the amount that you must reach before the split is noted in Government Code 77201.1B2. After these counties reach the amount, any excess revenues must be split 50-50 between state and county. 50% goes to the State Trial Court Improvement and Modernization Fund, and 50% to the County General Fund. Now, for additional information, please note that quarterly MOE, or maintenance of effort payments, and the amount used to determine the 50-50 split are two different amounts. Quarterly MOE payments should be based off of Government Code 77201.3, and the 50-50 split should be based off of Government Code 77201B2 or Government Code 77205A, depending on your county. MOE payments are taken from specified revenues. Otherwise, the county has to pay the difference from its general fund. The Government Code 77205A payment is due to the state 45 days after the end of the fiscal year, which is August 15th. If remittances are received after this due date of August 15th, delinquent penalties will be calculated pursuant to Government Code 68085. Now, the amounts determined from the calculations should be totaled for the entire fiscal year, and this calculation should be based consistently either on the accrual or cash basis. Hopefully, the information from these findings will help you to be more aware of the issues that may come up the next time you're audited by our Division of Audits. Again, this is Michael Gungun of the Local Government Policy Section in SEO's Division of Accounting and Reporting. If you have any questions on what we have presented or on court revenue distribution, feel free to send your inquiries on court revenue distribution to this email address, localgovpolicy@seo.ca.gov. With that, back to Andy.
Thank you. All right, this is going to be the last formal break before we go into the home stretch. So if you have questions for the Judicial Council audit team or for the State Controller's Office audit team, again, using that WebEx chat feature, please direct those questions to Maria Lira. Now we're going to move into the final few slides, and they're on the same level as housekeeping. We're looking forward to in-person trainings in the spring. They will be regionally located. there will be plenary sessions and then breakout groups. Our ability to provide you with the quality information that you need to enhance your distribution systems would be informed if you could provide us feedback with what you would like to see, what you would like to learn, how interactive you would like that session to be. So please send any suggestions you have for the breakout groups, for the spring trainings, to revenue distribution at jud.ca.gov. Now, for a lot of you, you've been doing this for a while, and there really is some method to the madness. For those of you who are newer, here's a pretty easy checklist of how to go about understanding how to make a distribution. Start by reading the statute. All of these have their birth in legislation. Reading the statute may provide you with some information that's very helpful, so we encourage you to start there. If you're not getting the clarity you need, the next step would be to look at the SCO's trial court revenue distribution guidelines. Again, for those of you who knew it under its former name, Appendix C, you're looking for the trial court revenue distribution guidelines. You might also consult the Uniform Bail and Penalty Schedule. That's a great resource. And then looking at the FAQs, not just the current FAQs, but as Daniel pointed out, we maintain those FAQs for previous years, and they are referenced not only here in this presentation for past years, but you'll find them on the websites. And then, of course, if you're not getting the answer that you need, if you still need additional guidance and support, please direct your questions to the State Comptroller's Office or Judicial Council staff, and these are the email addresses to send your questions and concerns. For the State Comptroller's Office, that would be localgovpolicy@sco.ca.gov, and for Judicial Council, it would be revenuedistribution@jud.ca.gov. This next slide is going to provide you with all of the resources I just mentioned and that have been mentioned throughout this training. You don't have to try and copy down all of these URLs now. You will have access to that information. But just know that we're doing everything we can to make this at least understandable. I don't know that we're going to make distributions enjoyable at any time soon. That's the job of the Futures Commission. Our job is just to help you navigate through the current system, and hopefully this information provides you with what you need. Now, over the course of the past 90 minutes, several of you have submitted questions, and some of those questions we're going to be able to answer right now. Others of those questions are a little meatier, and we will have to get back to you. We will also include them in the FAQs as time goes by, but I'm going to start by calling on the team in Burbank. Are there any questions down there that you received that we can answer today?
Andy, this is Maria. No, I believe the SCO is going to respond to a couple of the questions that we received.
All right, very good. San Francisco, any questions that you have that you can answer?
Courtney.
There was a question that came in on the Rule 4.105. Again, this is Courtney Tucker. The question is, if the defendant does sign a promise to appear and requests a court trial or trial by written declaration without first appearing for arraignment, they must post bail, correct? Technically, that is correct. However, the issue is that just because they've made the request, that doesn't mean that they absolutely have to post bail. The court needs to notify them of the other options they have to appear without posting bail. The rule specifies that in any information provided by the court about bail, they have to provide information about how to appear without posting bail. So it's not like saying, I want to go to trial without going into arraignment, or I want to have my trial by written declaration, you must post bail. They have to tell them what the alternatives are to appear without posting bail, and then they have the choice to post bail or not post bail by going to arraignment. I get calls all the time from people saying, oh, they're violating the rule because they're requiring that I post bail. I'm like, well, the statute requires that you post bail. The rule does not override the statute. If you're asking for a trial by written declaration, the statute requires bail. If you're asking either at the counter or by mail to appear for trial without going to arraignment first, 4.40519 of the Vehicle Code requires that you post bail. So I don't know if the answer is that the courts provide a copy of the rule itself to the defendants so that they can clearly see their exceptions to the no bail default, or if the courts, you know, is better about providing them with the statutory references. Oh, you're asking for trial by written declaration, then for under 40902 of the Vehicle Code, you're required to post bail. Oh, you're asking for trial without going to arraignment first? 40519 of the Vehicle Code requires that you post bail. If you want to avoid that, you go to arraignment, and you don't have to post bail to go to your arraignment.
Anything else?
Yeah, this is John Jednik. We had a question that came in yesterday about report the ROR, or report on revenues, that is typically sent in, as to whether or not it would be updated for the amnesty dollars. And in talking with the JCC budget office, the answer is no, they're not going to update that report of revenues, on revenues. Also, there was a question concerning does audit services have Board of Supervisor resolutions in case a court needs those? And the answer is we have some. We do the audits. We get them when we do the audits. We don't provide them because we want to ensure that, you know, you get the most current ones, and that's go to the county, get the most current resolutions. Another question was, where are audit services audit reports similar to state controllers? And our audit reports are on the California Court website under the reports section, and we have posted those since 2010. If you're searching for those prior to 2010, you're supposed to put in the request, and we will provide those. Additionally, a question about the spreadsheets that are used and are posted on the websites of both state controllers and of the JCC. Do these cover all statutory violations? And the answer is no. We, I think, posted the, what I'll call the top 19 that we use most of the time. But there are a lot of others out there, and I know that one of the case management system vendors has provided over 70 spreadsheets covering a significant number of additional violations, and that is not on the website, and we have not looked at those and have not certified those, nor audit services nor state controllers has certified those. So if there are questions about those, we may be able to look at them, but, you know, those are being done by the vendor as they're doing configurations. Also, what if we note that the question came in about what if you're out there working and you note that a judicial order, for example, the domestic violence fee, and the order comes through at 400, not 500, what do I do? And the answer is you go back to the judicial officer and explain the concern, indicate why it's in error, and hopefully the judicial officer will concur and change the order. If they do not change the order, you have to let it go, and that order becomes, you know, what you have to comply with. But we would inform operational management in either the court or county to ensure they know about it, and hopefully that's more of an educational effort to the judges. That's it for San Francisco, Andy.
Great, thank you. I think we have a few up here that the state controller's team is going to answer.
Yes, we do. First question I did want to reserve is we had reports that one of our listeners had an issue signing up for the listserv notification. I just wanted to do a reminder that if you're trying to type in that link that we provided you, that you are typing in an underscore between each of the words there. So it would be www.seo.ca.gov/ard_trial_courts_notification_email.html. You can also, again, go to the Trial Courts Revenue Distribution Guidelines website, and at the bottom of that page, there is a link to the listserv notification that you can click on. Another question came in, does the SEO use a process for communicating updates to the TC31 form? The TC31 forms are revised annually as necessary.
We will be coordinating with the TC31 unit to communicate future revisions using our new listserv notification process. So again, we want to encourage you to sign up for our notification process to make sure that you're getting updates and announcements as they come out. A couple questions that we had yesterday that I wanted to just repeat to people on the TC31. One person asked, is the star that was on the slide, just on the slide or on the form itself? That star is on the TC31 form for the Amnesty Program line item. Again, if you are using a form that does not have that star, you do not have the current TC31 form, and you should double-check that and download the current form. The other question in filling out the form, is the year indicated on the TC31 form the calendar year or the fiscal year? That would be the fiscal year that you wish to enter on your TC31 form. And I know we have some other questions that require some research. We'll be getting back to you as we can. But I want to thank everyone who submitted questions to the controller's office. Andy?
Thank you. If you didn't hear your question answered, please know that we will get back to you. A lot of the questions require additional detail and collaborative thinking. So it's not an attempt to evade the answer. It's a question to get you the quality answer that you need to proceed. And finally, you will be receiving an evaluation for this program, and I speak for all of us when I say we live and die by your evaluations, and all of us will be heartbroken, none more than I, if you fail to turn them in. So please remember when you receive that evaluation to give us your feedback. Now would be an okay time to request your training certificate. You have slogged through the past 90-plus minutes with us, and now you may request your training certification at revenuedistribution@jud.ca.gov. This PowerPoint, in a form that you will be able to access the links on it, will be posted by Friday of this week, December 11th. You'll find that at the website here, www.courts.ca.gov/revenue-distribution. And then please expect email notification when recording of training and materials are posted, and they will be posted at that same website. I want to thank all of you for taking so much time out of your morning today, and I want to thank my co-presenters from the Controller's Office and from the various Judicial Council offices. Please let us know how we can make these trainings work for you, especially the in-person trainings in May. And with that, thank you all, and we look forward to hearing from and working with you in the future.